Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Prime Minister of Sri Lanka, Mahinda Rajapaksa, was forced to resign. His brother, however, remains president despite ongoing protests and a dire food and fuel crisis. We'll discuss the political and economic crises in this island nation of Sri Lanka. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On May 9th of this year, Sri Lankan Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa was forced to resign his position. This is despite the fact that his brother, Gotabaya, is the president of the nation. They're both part of a quasi-dynastic Rajapaksa family, which has dominated Sri Lankan politics for the last 20 years or so. The nation is in economic turmoil, and that day was one of the most violent in its history. Sri Lanka has apparently less than $1 million in foreign reserves, dwindling medical supplies, and almost no fuel. And President Gotabaya Rajapaksa is attempting to hold on to power by shuffling the cabinet as the nation continues to deteriorate and the protests continue. On today's show, we will explore the political and economic crisis that roils the island nation of Sri Lanka. Our panel today is Bhavani Fonseca, senior researcher and attorney at law with the Center for Policy Alternatives think tank. She is the editor of Transitional Justice in Sri Lanka, Moving Beyond Promises, and the author of The Long Wait for Justice on the Chronic Failures of Criminal Justice in Sri Lanka. Ambika Satkunanathan, human rights lawyer and fellow at the Open Society Foundation. She's the author of Authoritarian Inefficiency and the Undermining of Democracy in Sri Lanka, Justice in Transition Victims, Forgiveness and Truth-Seeking in Post-War Sri Lanka and Securitization and Militarization in Sri Lanka, a Continuum. And Ahalan Kadirmar, senior lecturer at the University of Jaffna. He is the author of Rebuilding the Post-War North and co-author of The Political Economy of the Crisis in Sri Lanka. All of our guests are joining us from Sri Lanka. Thank you all very much for joining us. Bhavani Fonseca, I'll start with you. What is the nature of this crisis? What led to the events of May the 9th?
Thanks, Doug, for having me and hosting this conversation. There's a lot more than what happened on the 9th that really needs to look into to understand what's happening in Sri Lanka. In terms of the present crisis, it's both a political and an economic. And as you quite rightly said, on the 9th, we also saw the violence and the security dimension, and that also requires some attention. But going back to what really led to this crisis, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, the president, was elected in 2019 on the platform of stability, security, economic prosperity. And that also in the heels of a devastating Easter Sunday attack. So one needs to remember that he came in the backdrop of violence, there's fear, suspicion, and very much on ethno-majoritarian platform of, I represent the Sinhala Buddhist, the majority community. So that was his position. But soon after he took office, there were several policy measures taken that had a severe impact in terms of the economy and the financial situation in Sri Lanka, mainly the tax cuts, but also international developments such as the pandemic, all of that contributed to where we are now. So it's a combination, but the president and his government promised a very technocratic governance model, pushed through constitutional amendments in 2022 that provided for greater consolidation within the executive arm. So really authoritarian practices were seen in the last 2.5 years. And then the militarization dimension under this government, we have seen a high number of former and military personnel taking up key positions, and including in the pandemic response, and we can go into some of this. So What we're seeing is a very strong ruler who promised so much in 2019, consolidated power, and since 2019 really saw authoritarian and militarized governance impacted reconciliation. But on the economic front, it was a disastrous turn with several mismanagement and policy incoherence. So, you know, really kind of a spectacular disaster in a way. At the same time, one needs to remember that the president and the Rajapaksa family, really there was a lot of nepotism and corruption seen. So that dimension also needs to be factored in. And what happened on the 9th of May was really a tipping point where the calls for the resignation of the president and the prime minister that had been there for several months now, and peaceful protesters demanding for a system change, there's suddenly violence that erupted. So this is in a nutshell what happened, but with that violence, the prime minister's resignation came through, but it also showed an ugly side in Sri Lanka in terms of the organized nature of violence that spread across Sri Lanka. Several deaths happened, and now we're confronted with not just the political dimension, but also issues of accountability as to what happened on the 9th, but also accountability that goes back decades, linked to the Rajapaksas as well. So there are multiple issues, but in a nutshell, these are some of the things worth looking at.
Absolutely. And Ambika, Sri Lanka has a long history of democracy. It's actually one of the longer operating democracies, definitely in the global south. But it seems, I mean, at one level, this is very much a crisis of democratic rule and a crisis of, as Bhavani pointed out, of accountability. I know you've done work on issues of justice. How much is Sri Lankan democracy under threat here?
So thank you for having me on, Doug. And that's a great question, actually, because as you said, it is one of the oldest democracies. But I think, as I've always maintained, democratic values have not really or never been internalized. And people viewed democracy as merely going and voting and not really what takes place in between votes, which is where I think the role of the citizen becomes really important, critical, to hold politicians accountable. And that tradition of holding people in positions of power or, you know, our elected representatives accountable is something that we have not seen. Also because of our political and social culture as well, where rather our society still got feudal elements, patronage is what operates, politicians use their positions to dispense patronage. That is why, for instance, we have a bloated, humongous public service that also is inefficient. Therefore, I would say those values were not internalized and politicians are viewed as, in a way, demigods. Right? That is the culture that exists. In that context, I would say we have a crisis of governance. And that is something that is also not particular to this government, but we have seen successive governments, there have been instances of crisis of governance, also due to the lack of internalization of democratic values. So in that context, right now, what we have is crisis of governance. But where democracy is concerned, I would say this moment is something that has shown that people are beginning to internalize democratic values. They now understand that their role is to hold politicians accountable. They're asking questions. They are protesting. They are demanding accountability. That also, it depends on which issues they ask for, etc. But generally, I think it's about, okay, you need to give us answers. You need to listen to our voice and you need to be transparent. So those basic elements at least are there. So I would term it that way, in the sense of there's a crisis of governance, but where democracy is concerned, I would say this moment has a lot of potential and is showing that finally, perhaps those democratic values are being internalized.
Very interesting. Ahalan Kadirgamar. I know that we're in Sri Lanka in a sort of a unique challenge in that, I mean, when I think of Sri Lanka, I think of the ongoing civil war that ended in 2009 and then moving into this post-conflict stage and, you know, the hope for increased, you know, peace building, you know, building institutions to try to maintain a peace. I guess the first question is how successful has the peace building gone since 2009, and how much of this current crisis is linked back to the way in which that war ended and then decisions the state made in the immediate aftermath?
When we think of peace building, I think we can actually break that down. So there's actually the kind of the reconciliation question. There's about constitutional reform and the political solution. But if I'm to focus much more on the post-war reconstruction and development on the economic side, there was both reconstruction in the war-torn North and East. And in fact, my own PhD dissertation was on the post-war reconstruction of the North, which I characterize as a failure. And the reason for that failure is that the government, as well as the large donors, whether it's the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, there was a lot of money that was poured in, but they focused only on rebuilding infrastructure and expanding credit through financialization, which actually only ended up indebting the population. You needed much more of rural reconstruction that didn't happen. But this process was paralleled with neoliberal development in the entire country, with a lot of capital flowing into the country. If you look at what happened to our stock market soon after the end of the war, it quadrupled in the next 18 months. It was considered the best performing stock market in the world even. And there was a lot of investment in the beautification of Colombo, of urban infrastructure. And a lot of this infrastructure was built on debt and a lot of borrowing also from the global capital markets, which I would argue is actually, the longer kind of causes of this debt crisis that we are in, right? All this infrastructure development that happened all over the country. So the war and its aftermath, the last 13 years, is very much linked to the economic crisis that we are going through. Though I also tend to argue that it's even longer than that. Sri Lanka was the first country in South Asia to liberalize its economy towards liberalizing trade, liberalizing capital flows. So that has also had an impact now as we're facing a food crisis, where we've become dependent on imported foods and our agricultural sector was neglected. So all of this has come together in informing this very severe economic crisis.
Ahalan, I'd like to follow up with that too. This question about the food crisis, has that been exacerbated as a result of COVID? Because I know that, I mean, trade flows generally, you know, had been disrupted. Are there other causes that's causing this food disruption crisis?
In the recent times, I would point to three factors, even though, as I mentioned, Sri Lanka had been neglecting agriculture and agricultural production and the food system for decades. With COVID, of course, with the lockdowns, there was disruption. And we were concerned about the food system, but actually people turned to agriculture, right? Because we still have a fairly large rural society and economy. So when services were disrupted, when migrant work wasn't possible, a lot of people turned to agriculture. But then the second factor, which is, you know, it baffles everyone, a disastrous policy on the part of the president, where overnight last year, he decided to ban all imports of chemical fertilizers, claiming that overnight they're going to switch to organic agriculture. Now, that has devastated our agriculture. You know, agricultural economists, agronomists claim that agricultural production has probably fallen by anywhere from 30 to 50% in Sri Lanka. And that has contributed to this food crisis. So we are in an economic crisis where we don't have the foreign exchange to import food. And we've also crippled our own food production. So it's a double whammy, so to speak. And then third, of course, as we are seeing now with the war in Ukraine, global commodity prices have gone up. Fertilizer prices have gone up. So we banned fertilizers. Now they're saying they're willing to import fertilizers, but fertilizer prices have gone up. And the government is in no position to provide the fertilizer subsidy to the farmers, where now they're going to have to pay, you know, four or five times the price for fertilizers. So it becomes a much more difficult prospect for agriculture in Sri Lanka.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ongoing political and economic crisis in Sri Lanka with Bhavani Fonseca of the Center for Policy Alternatives, Ambika Satkunanathan of the Open Society Foundation, and Ahalan Kadirgamar of the University of Jaffna. And Bhavani Fonseca, you had referenced that as well, this decision on, you know, food policy. It seems also a political crisis then too. When you've got power so centralized, you can have a leader make that kind of decision, you know, clearly without any sort of input from relevant parts of society that could just leave the country crippled.
Yes, Doug, and that's one of the key problems. But one has to remember the executive president and the all-powerful executive president is not something new. We've had that for several decades, and successive presidents have abused the power. There's been only a few instances of real reform to introduce checks and balances in Sri Lanka. But under the Rajapaksas, one can easily say that that power has, especially under Gotabaya Rajapaksa's presidency, that power has really expanded. And, you know, to a point where we are now in this crisis where people are actually having conversations that many of us have tried to have for several decades in terms of how do you hold key actors accountable? How do you address checks and balances? How do you ensure there's political accountability in Sri Lanka? I mean, that's one of the key problems we've had for decades. So really, it's quite ironic that this unprecedented crisis has made people question. And the conversations now is about trying to reform these institutions and bringing change in the political landscape. How far that goes, we don't know. I mean, unfortunately, what we're seeing is compromises already underway within the political landscape where, you know, there is now an attempt to abolish the executive presidency, which is a very, very important reform if that goes through. But already there's conversations of not abolishing, but maintaining some powers within the executive. So, you know, these attempts also we need to keep in mind within the present landscape. But coming back to the crisis, I think it's extremely important that one individual was able to get the country to this situation, and thousands are suffering because of that situation. But I also want to bring in the accountability dimension. Many of us have been pushing for accountability within Sri Lanka as well as outside. I mean, Sri Lanka is before the UN Human Rights Council. There is a resolution. There are different attempts in respective jurisdiction to try to bring in accountability for past violations. Also, I think for the audience in the US, there was a case filed against Gotabaya Rajapaksa before he became president. But so these attempts at accountability are not new. I mean, that has been there. But now it's also got to a point of questioning how the present situation is linked to those accountability measures. So, I mean, there's some interesting conversations while we experience this crisis in Sri Lanka.
And I have to follow up, Bhavani, on since you raised that issue about the president being accused of human rights violations and questions of accountability. Apparently, he was served papers here in California. Is that correct?
Yes, there was a case in California linked to the assassination of a very prominent editor in Sri Lanka in 2009. And his daughter actually was the litigant in that situation. But unfortunately, that case couldn't proceed because he became president. Gotabaya Rajapaksa became president, and with the office comes immunities. But that doesn't mean there won't be other attempts, you know, and I think this comes back to the point of why are key actors holding on to office when they are facing extreme unpopularity in the country. I mean, a survey we did a couple of weeks ago indicated that 87% of Sri Lankans want the president to leave office. And a key demand of the protesters have been go home, Gotabaya. So there is no doubt that many are calling for his resignation, including his resignation, but also political reforms. So there is a clear sign that there needs to be reckoning and accountability. But that particular case also speaks to the failures of accountability in Sri Lanka. You know, for decades, victims have tried to obtain accountability in Sri Lanka. There's been so many setbacks, and there is such an entrenched culture of impunity many face, and I mean, and including serving military officials and former military officials. So, you know, in that climate, many do look to international avenues for accountability. But then, of course, you have legal impediments in obtaining that as well. But there is definitely these things are worth looking at into the future.
Two key points that you raised. First is the demands to hold leaders accountable and the demands for justice. And those are always, I mean, at some level, I'm always reminded of the famous saying that let justice be done, though the heavens may fall. In some of these cases, it becomes a reason why the leader wants to hold power and kind of does everything they can to hold power with that. And also a reminder that though perhaps you can seek out avenues in the global north and countries like the United States, this is an issue that needs to be resolved within Sri Lanka for so many reasons. But Ambika, you painted a picture here where this is a population that's protesting, that's rising up and demanding accountability. So much of the emphasis in the Western press on this case has been on the repression coming from the president. But are we missing, you know, some of the story that this is not just a question of president repression, but one where the population, where Sri Lankans are starting to seize control of, you know, of their government and demanding democratization and accountability?
The repression, yes. But that, once again, is something that is not new to Sri Lanka, as you may be aware. We've had gross human rights violations for decades, linked to the conflict, not linked to the conflict, but it comes back to a violent state where power is concentrated, where police brutality is systemic, and also, although militarization was it existed due to the armed conflict. We saw an escalation of that post-war. So in that sense, the repression is not new, but the Rajapaksas took repression to a new level, just as they took authoritarianism to a new level. So I think for the southern population, a lot of the repression that was experienced by the Tamil community, the Muslim community, by journalists, by civil society, by dissidents, that was not something that they experienced. I mean, they would have experienced it during the JVP insurrection, but not after that, and particularly not after the end of the war. For that population, I think now is when they are experiencing that. Of course, if you're a marginalized community, you would have experienced that because, for instance, an LGBTIQ person, someone who's poor, when they go to the police or the police picks them up, they are arrested, assaulted, maybe end up in prison, do not have money to pay a lawyer to get bail, etc. So there are certain populations that were always marginalized that experienced the violence of the state, but for a large majority of them, they're experiencing it now because of the economic crisis. They can also see, and something else that I focus on is structural violence, right? So the fact that they cannot get gas and they wait in line for 3 days, and that means they cannot cook, and that means they cannot a daily wage earner, cannot go out and earn their daily wage, and they cannot feed their family. That is structural violence. So they are experiencing structural violence. And when they experience structural violence, they're also challenging the state, challenging the regime, asking for accountability, which is when they experience the other forms of personal violence. Crack down on the protests using tear gas, the abuse of law to arrest, arbitrary arrests and detention. I think so that is how the larger population is experiencing it. So now they're also, we find that there is general understanding of the violent nature of the state and particularly of this regime and how it abuses the law and law enforcement. So what we hope is that increasingly larger number of people will see this. And that I think is important if we want any meaningful change. It is important for more and more people to become aware of this.
And also, Ambika, the follow-up, these protests are what have, again, gained so much of the international press and this realization of what's been going on in Sri Lanka. Are these protests pretty organized? Are these groups that are coordinating pretty closely? Have they been largely spontaneous kinds of, you know, statements of discontent and anger at the state?
It's a mix of a lot of things. And also, I would like to point out that in the north and the east, for instance, there have been peaceful protests that have been ongoing nonstop for more than 1,900 days. That is of the families of the disappeared. And also, although disappearance is a problem that we've seen over the decades, these protests also focus specifically on the Rajapaksa. So in that sense, there are people in the north and the east who have been challenging the Rajapaksas for several years now. And of course, they have been protesting in the north and the east, also local protests, spontaneous, against, over the last few years, against military acquisition, occupation of land. In the south, the protests that we see are also the different kinds, in the sense of you have at the Gaul face, I call that, I use the term kind of a flagship, right? That's like the flagship space or protest where you have diverse groups, more than even 50 different groups that have come that occupy the space. You have that. Then you have, so that I would say is organized and not organized at the same time. Not organized in how they came there, but organized in how they manage and occupy the space and share the space. Of course, there are the Inter-University Students Federation that has been playing a key role in these protests. They've been driving many of the protests, but at the same time, you also have spontaneous protests. When people queue for kerosene, when they queue for gas, locals who are angry, they've been waiting for 3 days and they block the road. Therefore, it's a unique, it's quite varied and it's quite complex, which is also, I think, goes back to that violence post 9th May violence as well, which is also quite similar in that it is complex, it's varied and messy, definitely messy.
When we come back, what role do outside powers and lenders play in exacerbating Sri Lanka's economic crisis? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. the Rajapaksa regime of Sri Lanka has ruled over political, economic, and fuel crises. Will this ongoing crisis now lead to the fall of the Rajapaksa regime in Sri Lanka? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Sri Lanka has been roiled in a political and economic crisis that has been brewing for several months, in fact, perhaps, you know, in some cases, years. But on May the 9th, it particularly came to a head with the forced resignation of Sri Lankan Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa. We're discussing this ongoing crisis with our panel today. All of our guests are joining us from Sri Lanka. Bhavani Fonseca of the Center for Policy Alternatives Think Tank, Ambika Satkunanathan of the Open Society Foundation, and Ahalan Kadirgamar of the University of Jaffna. So Ahalan, I'd like to turn to you at this point. I know that one country that has been invested, lending a lot of money, and certainly played a substantial role in some of Sri Lanka's economic challenges, if not the crisis itself, is China. And that Sri Lanka has been receiving quite a bit of funding, the Belt and Road Initiative loans, et cetera, that the Chinese, you know, have given. How much is this what's generally been open lines of credit that apparently have been used in some ways that really haven't helped the country terribly much? How much of that has been contributing to this crisis?
Yeah, there is, of course, a lot of geopolitical tensions over Sri Lanka. China being one actor, India, the United States, and there's been a lot of attention on China. When we look at the foreign debt, Sri Lanka's foreign debt, because this is really a balance of payments crisis and a foreign debt crisis that has blown up into a full-blown economic crisis. Sri Lanka's external debt, only 10% goes to China. Another 10% goes to Japan. The real problem has been about 53% in commercial borrowings, of which about 40% of our external debt is sovereign bonds. So it's really a sovereign bond crisis. The problem with investment and that has come into Sri Lanka is that most of it has gone into infrastructure. So whether it's Chinese investment or even multilateral investment from the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, a lot of highways, roads, ports, harbors, but they have not provided the returns, and which is what has really pushed us into this crisis. And the same with commercial borrowings. If you look at sovereign bonds on which we have now defaulted since 2007, we started floating sovereign bonds in the international capital markets. And the interest rates range from, you know, 5% to over 8%, say an average of 7 to 7.5%. And these are 10-year bonds. So in effect, your interest payment equal your principal by the time you repay it. And there's no returns to show for. So that's what's caused the crisis. I would say, rather than any one country, it's the lack of a clear development vision on the part of the Sri Lankan government where development should bring in the returns if we are to invest with foreign capital. That has really been the problem in terms of the economic crisis. But in the international media, there's been a lot of conflation of the sort of geopolitical tensions with what has been the economic crisis. And that's where China has gained a lot of attention.
Yeah, and on the China case, Ahalan, the emphasis seems to be quite a bit on issues of corruption and actually very closely tied to the Rajapaksa family, money being spent for their own sort of personal gain or for the gain, you know, for the area from which they come from. You know, is that overstated or are there really connections as well to issues of corruption and nepotism?
Well, there's very strong allegations of corruption against the Rajapaksa regime. And the protests actually have been mobilized around this issue of nepotism and corruption. my own analysis of the situation is that, yes, there's been corruption. There were allegations of corruption against the previous government as well. And those have to be dealt with through due process. But there is a much larger problem here of the lack of a clear economic development vision and the kind of investment that's been happening. So even if you look at foreign direct investment, you know, and that's really supposed to create production and employment, much of the, you know, over a majority of the foreign direct investment that came in, which is not a large amount, say averaging $1 to $2 billion a year, has gone into real estate investment, right? Into sort of luxurious condominiums, those kinds of investment. And you'll see now in Colombo that there, you know, Colombo in the last 10 years after the war has been completely transformed. And in fact, the beautification of it was led by the current president, who was defense secretary in the previous Mahinda Rajapaksa government after the war. And they brought urban development under the defense ministry. So there was a merging of security and urbanization, along with which there was a lot of investment. So these are very complex issues of how development as a whole has been diverted away from the needs of the country.
And Bhavani, then it sounds like, I mean, what Ahlan's describing is a lack of investment in human capital, lack of investment in the population itself, and instead the emphasis on infrastructure. I can't help but think part of that has to be tied to the nature of governance as well, because leaders like to build big things and put their name on it. You know, so how much is this lack of emphasis on, you know, developing the population, human development, tied to the political crisis?
Well, I mean, I think that's a good question, Doug, in terms of looking at what just under the Rajapaksas, and when I say under the Rajapaksas, this predates Gotabaya Rajapaksa's presidency. I mean, we're looking at also what happened in 2005 to 2015 under the Mahinda Rajapaksa presidency. That's the present president's brother, who is also the former prime minister. It's quite convoluted in if you start looking at the Rajapaksas. But there's, I mean, as Ahilan quite rightly said, there is just this kind of prioritization of the development agenda for populists, their own populist agendas. No? And we saw that in terms of election campaigns, we saw in 2010 and 2015 also that they promised development over rights, over a political solution. And in 2010, that was kind of something many agreed to in terms of, at least in the South, there was this recognition after nearly three decades of a war, we need to see development. That development agenda was given priority by many in Sri Lanka. 2015, because of the corruption and the nepotism, all of that, there was a clear message from the voters saying enough of that. We need to see a different culture. But unfortunately, the pendulum swung again in 2019. So even the people do recognize that these things come at a cost. And now we're seeing the impact of it, where vulnerable communities are really suffering so much. If you look at the crisis at the present moment, there are segments of society who are unable to even have three meals a day. Medicine is in short supply, other essential items such as petrol, gas. So, you know, there is that crisis. And then you see these big construction projects such as a harbor, an airport, all in the Rajapaksa country in the South, not generating the income that it was meant to generate. So these are kind of questions as to what is the purpose of this, who actually gained from it. So yes, you have this moment where people are also starting to question who gained from all these development and the construction, and more questions as to financial dealings which enriched the Rajapaksas and those around them, when institutions that require funding did not get funding. I also want to say this in terms of when we're looking at the economic dimension, the budget of budget allocations proposed by the government, and very quickly I'll just say this, is that there is a huge shift towards defense spending and not for social services, not for health, not for education. Even during the pandemic, this was a criticism we raised, is during a pandemic, health sector should have been getting the most amount of funding. So there is definitely, in terms of different, not just a development agenda, but also budgetary allocations, the Rajapaksas were very clear. They did not care about the people. It was for the benefit and gain of their own. And that's playing out now in Sri Lanka.
I have to ask them, do they give any sort of justification for this securitized budget? I mean, I don't think of Sri Lanka as facing the kind of military threat from outside. What was the justification for spending so much money on the military?
So that's a very good question, Doug, is that, you know, if you look at some of the events of the recent past, you know, the whole question of the Easter Sunday attacks are now coming up, you know. I mean, who was to gain with these kind of events? Unfortunately, many paid the price with their lives. And there was, ethno-nationalist violence and rhetoric that came about it. But who really gained from this? And there are now investigations that were conducted that raises a lot of questions in terms of the Rajapaksas themselves and those around them. And the question of, do these events lead to the justification of greater entrenched militarization and securitization? And even the May 9th violence, I mean, the question is, did the military step up? When there was clear evidence violence was spreading, violence was getting out of control, was this whole justification of having a large defense budget really playing out to protect the lives of citizens and property? So lots of questions. And, you know, interestingly, yesterday we had an announcement that the present army commander was leaving his post and a new army commander was coming in from the end of the month, I mean, from the 1st of June. And the press, you know, there are also lots of questions around accountability around the present army commander, Shavindra Silva. He's designated by the State Department, so he's unable to travel to the US. So lots of questions in terms of accountability, but also in terms of security sector reform, the whole budgetary allocations, but a lot of questions as to, are particular events leading to greater military role, and then who is benefiting, but what is the impact on the citizen? So, I mean, maybe I'm not answering the question quite clearly, but there are lots of questions in terms of who is gaining from all of this. And is it manipulated?
Always a great question. You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ongoing political and economic crisis in Sri Lanka with Bhavani Fonseca of the Center for Policy Alternatives, Ambika Satkunanathan of the Open Society Foundation, and Ahilan Kadirgamar of the University of Jaffna. Ambika, it seems at the core of this crisis is the Rajapaksa family. This is a dynastic type of rule that, and even when you make references to governments 15 years ago, it seems to be to a Rajapaksa. I know there's been some divisions in the family. I mean, literally when you have the president demanding the resignation of the prime minister or the and the brothers, there has to be some sort of a division. Is the Rajapaksa family going to continue to dominate Sri Lankan politics, or are we going to see some change?
Doug, if you don't mind, I would also just like to quickly go back to the question about the military budget. As I said, because militarization due to the armed conflict is something that is not new, and high military budgets are also not new to Sri Lanka because of that. But what the interesting thing in Sri Lanka is that it is post-war that we saw more increase, and we saw militarization. Then that is because two factors. One is Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who was the Secretary of Defense. And as my analysis is that, you know, there are two pillars to his ideology and his strategies. One is Sinhala Buddhist nationalism, and the other is militarization. And since he was quite a powerful figure involving the military post 2009 in various civic activities, in business activities, etc., was something that was driven by him. That was merely paused momentarily during the good governance regime. They did not take any action to demilitarize, demobilize, or in any way resolve or dismantle that military industrial kind of complex that they had built up. And therefore, in 2019, when he came back to power, it was an acceleration. Also, because he's totally in power now, a very powerful executive president. So the two pillars of his ideology, we have seen him implement in various spheres. National security is also something that this government, previous governments too, but more this government has used to also retain power and to engage in, you know, take authoritarian measures, and to justify that, to crack down on rights, to crack down on dissent, is how I would see it. In terms of the Rajapaksas, I think, yes, they have dominated Sri Lankan politics. And I would say perhaps what we've seen, but also Sri Lankans have very short political memories. So therefore, perhaps what we might see is a sort of fading away, if at all, and a resurrection or resurgent like what is happening in the Philippines now with the Marcos family. But they are determined to stay in power, and even appointing Ranil Wickremesinghe as prime minister is part of their ploy to stay in power. So I would say, you know, the imagery of like a cat on a wall, holding on, barely holding on, but still there.
And Bhavani Fonseca, I'll ask you the same question. Is this a family that's going to stay on, or is it going to fall?
So Doug, everything that we've seen, and not just in the recent days and weeks, but in the recent past, shows that the Rajapaksas, and let me just say, the House of Rajapaksas, you know, it just kind of looks very similar to the House of Cards series. You know, the House of Rajapaksas are going to be very much around. They did have a huge impact in terms of their popularity a couple of weeks ago. But, they are very much surviving this storm. And in a matter of days, they've come back to really claim their position as the most kind of powerful political family in Sri Lanka. So they'll be around, but that said, what has happened in the recent weeks cannot be underestimated. The citizens have really galvanized peacefully, to a large extent, come to the streets tomorrow in Sri Lanka. The 50 days of the occupation of the epicenter of this struggle is going to see several protests and many more coming out. So the citizens are not going to go home either. So we are going to have this situation where the Rajapaksas will be around, but that space has been created where there will be more questions, calls for accountability, call for a system change. So it's not going to be in the same political landscape they can operate. But do not underestimate also the Rajapaksas and their handle in governance and politics in Sri Lanka. So it's going to be interesting times moving forward in different ways.
And Ahilan, I know you're based up north in the Tamil areas in Jaffna. First of all, do the Rajapaksas have any sort of support in that area? I would imagine, you know, they wouldn't. And is there a possibility of an alliance between Sinhalese who had opposed the Rajapaksas and the Tamils as a way to try to apply some pressure to possibly force them out.
In the last elections, when President Gotabaya Rajapaksa was elected, if you look at what happened, the minorities as a whole and both the Muslim community, who had been coming under a lot of attack over the last decade by Sinhala Buddhist nationalists with the backing of the Rajapaksas, as well as the Tamil community, voted en masse against Gotabaya Rajapaksa. But he had a landslide victory in the south among the Sinhala population, and that's how he came to power. So that historically, there's been a lot of opposition to the Rajapaksas in the north. The issue is that the Tamil community, the northern population, has not joined as actively in the protests in the south. And there are various reasons for that. Part of it is the history of militarization here. So that kind of spontaneous protests are much more subdued here. And also the Tamil nationalists who are opposed to Rajapaksa, on the other hand, they also have a very exclusivist agenda and not willing to work with even progressives in the south. So they don't want to mobilize at this point because they feel that their Tamil nationalist demands would be diluted. But I think as the economic crisis deepens, and unfortunately, that's the trajectory on which we are, they're likely to see more of these alliances forming inter-ethnically and people coming out. And as Bhavani and Ambika mentioned, the Rajapaksas have a lot to lose. There are so many allegations against them that they would not want to give up the presidency. They would want to hold on to power for their own protection. On the other hand, they have been completely delegitimized to start with among the minorities, and now in the south, that is going to be very hard for them to remain for long, but they will try to drag on with power. But the longer they stay, there won't be the kind of leadership necessary in this country to get us out of this economic crisis. So sooner or later, they're going to go, but the longer they drag this out, the worse the economic crisis is going to be, and that's of concern.
Being in Sri Lanka, that is a tropical bird you hear. And when I think of the economic crisis, I specifically think of the food crisis and that narrative. Is the food crisis hitting all parts of the nation, or is there a disproportion as to who's really been suffering?
It's affecting the entire country, and there are two aspects to it, not only food, but essential items like gasoline and cooking gas. And the problem is both shortages. So there are long queues to get, petrol or to get even milk powder sometimes, and there are shortages because we are unable to import enough goods. And on the other hand, there's also price hikes. The Sri Lankan rupee has, depreciated as much by 80%. And so all of that is being transferred to the consumers whose incomes have not gone up. And this has all happened in a very short period of time. The Sri Lankan rupee was 200 rupees to a US dollar. Now it's hovering somewhere around 350 or 360 rupees to a Sri Lankan dollar. So you can imagine the kind of price hike. So the shortages are affecting everyone, but those who are working people, those who are day wage laborers, whose incomes are dwindling, they're also having to pay almost double for a lot of these essential goods. So it's really a crushing crisis. And we worry that we are now going into almost, starvation and famine type of conditions if this continues without immediate relief.
Absolutely. And Ambika, we've got about 90 seconds left, and we've painted a pretty bleak picture, but you have provided some degree of optimism that this could present some sort of opportunity for a deepening of Sri Lankan democracy. How optimistic can we be?
Well, I think given I've been working on these issues for a long time, I think if one doesn't have optimism, then really wouldn't be still here. I would say we have to take the positives that have come of it, which is the fact that citizens are more aware, citizens are demanding. So I think it is up to us also, and that is when I say us, it's up to politicians, up to civil society, everyone to see how we can enable this, how we can make linkages, how we can build collectives, networks. So a lot of work to be done. It's a moment, but to make it more than that, there is still a lot of work to be done.
I wanted to end on a positive note, despite the fact that we all know that the economic crisis, the food crisis, the political crisis is quite deep. But Bhavani suggested the House of Cards. I'm going to suggest possibly Game of Thrones, that perhaps at the end of this, the fall of the House of Rajapaksa, I'm confident that that would be a positive development for Sri Lanka. And I have my hopes, I have my fingers crossed, we will continue to follow this ongoing crisis, this very important story about the nation of Sri Lanka. We've been talking about Sri Lanka's political and economic crisis on today's show. Our panel today has been Bhavani Fonseca, senior researcher and attorney at law with the Center for Policy Alternatives think tank. She's the editor of Transitional Justice in Sri Lanka, Moving Beyond Promises, and the author of The Long Wait for Justice on the Chronic Failures of Criminal Justice in Sri Lanka. Ambika Satkunanaton, human rights lawyer and fellow at the Open Society Foundation. She's the author of Authoritarian Inefficiency and the Undermining of Democracy in Sri Lanka, Justice in Transition, Victims, Forgiveness, and Truth-Seeking in Post-War Sri Lanka, and Securitization and Militarization in Sri Lanka, a Continuum. And Ahilan Kadirgamar, senior lecturer at the University of Jaffna. He is the author of Rebuilding the Post-War North and the co-author of The Political Economy of the Crisis in Sri Lanka. All of our guests are joining us from Sri Lanka. Thank you all very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian. உனக்கு இருக்குது ஒரு நல்ல எதிர்காலம் நல்லா இரு தம்பி இந்த நாட்டுக்கு நீங்க தான் வருங்காலம்